A few weeks ago, when he said, why don't you give a talk during PI Day and your title could be this? I said, sure, why not? And it mainly because it represents pretty much my state of mind with respect to several of the problems I would be describing, in that I'm far from equilibrium, because I still don't think we understand everything. And it's very chaotic, because depending on the day, I may think one way or another. But the motivation is try to understand out of equilibrium systems using the ADS-EFT correspondence, of which I don't have to describe for this audience. So the point of view is that we're going to be trying to say something about perhaps the behavior of field theories in D dimensions by going first through a gravitational problem in ADS, because we're thinking that the field theory is in the strongly coupled regime. And the duality tells us that this is a problem that is amenable to being described on the dual picture of ADS in this most robust state. Typically, people use this duality in the context of taking ADS, but just a Poincaré patch in ADS. And it's convenient because then this is the shaded region here. Upon a conformal transformation, what you have is a field theory living on flat spacetime, which is very convenient because that's describes or possibly describe toy models that represent the physics we want to understand every day. But in many applications, actually, I'm going to be interested more in the global ADS point of view, where the holography still also applies. But now we're doing a field theory in a curved spacetime. And you see why we're interested in that and how this, in the end, ties up with the question of thermalization. So far, I said there are many, many applications. I mean, since the paper of Maldacena, it's amazing how many works have come out. And from the point of view of someone who works in gravity, some of those applications may make you scratch your head, and I'll tell you why as we go along. Mainly because there are still lots of questions that are still unanswered, of which a lot of the bedrock of the duality and the applications are being laid on. So in particular, two important examples. And also, I should say that I'm being really bad with references. I'm going to be referencing mainly either salient works that you should perhaps go and want to check, but also mainly just referencing people that are in the building, because there are lots of people working in related problems here. So many of the applications of the duality to try to go after some interesting physics through gravity involves not out of equilibrium situations, but equilibrium situations mainly trying to understand the phase space analysis of very interesting problems, or ignoring the back reaction, which then is just describing things to leading order. So I'm more interested in the case where back reaction is involved and the nonlinear problem, gravitational problem, is important. So two of the main kind of representative examples of what people have been going after through with this are going to mention in these next transparencies. First is the quark gluon plasma. So people doing hadron collisions in accelerators, they're interested in answering what happens when these objects collide at very high energy. You generate this quark gluon plasma because essentially at those high energies you deconfine everything. And then as the system relaxes back to equilibrium, and forms particles again, you want to understand kind of this transition from the quark gluon plasma to the relaxation. And again, this is a regime where calculations through QCD are very complicated. The lattice problem is not well under control. But IDS-CFT gives perhaps a promise of trying to go after it through at least a toy model, which is super young meals. There's been quite an interesting amount of work here. And this is just an example of work by Paul Chesler and Larry Yaffe, where in the gravitational side, you just consider two shock waves that come together, collide, and then relaxes. And after the collision takes place, there are several questions that people want to understand. And they come with very complicated words that I'm not sure I can pronounce all of them correctly. One is thermalization. The other one is hadronization, at what point where you get back the hadrons. And the other one is hydrodynamization, which is at what point does the system begin to behave like a fluid and admit its hydrodynamic description. All of those, or at least the first two, are addressable with this correspondence. And this is just the result of the simulations. At this stage, you see these two shock waves that have collided. And in dashed lines here is a prediction of what you expect from relativistic hydrodynamics. And you see that after some short times, then the behavior of the shock wave that collided and they are extracting from the gravitational simulations, then they match perfectly the hydrodynamic description. Another one, there's a progress, some project that come under the name of quantum quenches. You basically want to understand the behavior of some system that is described by a given, say, Hamiltonian or Lagrangian, but you have a coupling term with to some operator with a given conformal dimension, and then you ask the question, what would be the state of the system and how it relaxes back depending on how rapid the transition or the quench takes place. And these simulations tell you that if the transition is very, very slow, very adiabatic, then the system responds in an adiabatic way, so it basically just follows the perturbation. But if this transition happens to be very, very rapid, then the system relaxes in a way that at the end of the day you understand quite nicely, just based on gravitational considerations. So you have a black hole that you have heated hard in a very short amount of time, that black hole would decay away on its quasi-normal mode spectra. And so eventually, the time scale for thermalization is given by the lowest quasi-normal mode that the black hole responds with. And the slowest one is the one that decays, of course, the slowest, which you can understand from a linearized analysis of Einstein's equations in IDS, provided a given background given by a given black hole. But more importantly, as I said, both these studies are numerical, and many of the things I'm going to be saying rely on numerical simulations. But as anyone that has ever written a code knows, the best thing a numerical code can do for you, and this I'm paraphrasing Avery Broderick, is to give you enough insights to throw the code away at the end of the day and come up with sufficient, ab initio or first principles understanding of the problem and then extend it forward. And this is what was done by this gentleman down here, also in the building, that took the insights provided by the simulation and they came up with a very interesting analytical understanding of how is it that this system relaxes to equilibrium. So these were just some examples to motivate where I'm going. So essentially, if you take the messages from these two works, you would say that, well, first, you'll have more, perhaps, faith in utilizing this duality to answer questions about dynamical processes. And in particular, you might be saying that, well, now that I understand it from the gravitational point of view, it could be generally the case that the return to thermalization will be given by these quasi-normal mode timescales. However, these were a little bit of perhaps deeper insights on the gravitational side makes you uncomfortable. The first thing is that we know for sure that quasi-normal modes are not a basis, not even in ADS spacetime. So if we attempt to even say we're going to use quasi-normal modes to describe generically what happens or how the system is going to thermalize, we may be missing important physics. And so that's a question. If I ignore that issue for a second, and I say, well, I still am going to be using the quasi-normal modes, it is still the case that there are many applications where the quasi-normal modes were not available. And just as an example, the quasi-normal modes for CAIR ADS in dimensions 4 and 5, which would be dual to doing field theories on a sphere, were not known till December last year. Furthermore, and this is perhaps getting more into the uncomfortable regime, we don't know if even if Kerr ADS or even Schwarzschild ADS is unstable, is stable. So again, a lot of the foundation here is to say, well, we have a thermal state, we perturb it, and we see how it relaxes. Well, we don't know, we don't even have the analog theorems that we have in the asymptotic flat case that will tell us at a later time we're convinced that the state of the system will be described by a black hole, another Kerr ADS black hole. In fact, there are arguments there by mathematicians that would say, we know or we conjecture that CAIR ADS is unstable. And if you're interested, we can go into those details. But even if we ignore that for a second, we may be interested in saying, well, at least there are some regimes where we are going to still ignore everything else, and we're going to try to understand things via quasi-normal modes. Well, it's not the case, it's not necessarily the case that you kick something with a given perturbation, that the main decay will be governed by the same perturbation. So the question is where some nonlinear effects can trigger and transfer the energy from those given modes into some other ones, and those could have very different decay rates. And finally, we might be also trying to understand the question of where we have a field theory that initially is not in any thermal state, but we just put some energy there and we want to know what happens as the system tries to reach some sort of equilibrium. And this has a lot of resonance with the talk that Dima gave. So I'll give you some examples of these as we go along. So the first is to try to go after some of the questions I raised before. So what, if any, right do we have to think that in the regimes where the duality applies, to go safely assuming the quasi-neural modes will provide for us insights in the thermalization process of the system. So in particular, the question is, well, what if phenomena like turbulence takes place in general relativity? And I'll tell you why we might wonder about that. But before that, I have to paraphrase US Supreme Court justice as to what is turbulence. So turbulence is something that is hard to define in rigorous terms. And many people will say, well, I know what is turbulence when I see it. But let's just concentrate on a few building blocks of turbulence where I think we would all agree would be properties that we would require turbulence to display. So already in the Navier-Stokes case, we know that when we have a turbulent system, the system, if we had any symmetry, it would be broken. It might be recovered in a statistical sense, but generically it's broken. Some modes that were not existent even initially might grow up exponentially for some time and then will decay if we're not driving the system continuously pumping or replenishing the energy that they lose as they go down to the viscous scale. Some norms of the solution, again, global norms will keep decaying if we're not driving it, but some of them, some modes of the solutions will grow exponentially and then might decay with a power law and then, again, at very late times, will be governed by another exponential, which is the new, if you want, quasi-neural modes of the slowest one that can decay where the energy got transferred into. And there are different properties of energy cascades. So we're going to see if the same thing may happen in gravity, and in particular in the ADS case. So when you try to think or even postulate where turbulence can happen in gravity, there were arguments against it. And some of us in the general relativity camp, we heard them maybe a decade ago. People were saying, come on, there couldn't be turbulence because of the following reasons. One is we know the spectra of quasi-neural modes, they all decay. Turbulence has some mode that grow exponentially, so how can it be there? We also have numerical simulations showing, say, even collisions with black holes, where you see structure that gets formed through this very nonlinear interaction. But this structure is such that it always goes into longer wavelengths, so this doesn't look like turbulence. And we were doing 3+1 hydrodynamic gravitational simulations. They don't behave at all like 3+1 hydrodynamic turbulence. And also, we know that in the inviscid case, hydrodynamics has shocks and turbulence, and general relativity cannot have shocks. And so then people put those two things together to argue that you couldn't have turbulence in gravity. However, the ADS-CFT comes and says something completely different. It says that there is a duality between ADS and field theories, and field theories at sufficiently high energy, or iterating small degrees of freedom, admit a hydrodynamic description. Therefore, there is a fluid gravity correspondence, if you will, and it's applicable when people understand this, when this is manifested, is in the case of very long wave perturbations in the black hole spacetime. So the wavelength of your perturbations times the temperature, it has to be much larger than one, but the temperature scales like the density of the fluid divided by the viscosity of the fluid, and this is almost the Reynolds number. So the Reynolds number in hydrodynamics is the wavelength times rho divided by the viscous parameters times the velocity, but velocity is bounded by one, so the duality naturally puts us in a regime where turbulence may kick in. And there is also the membrane paradigm that, and I think Laurent might talk a little bit about it, that has already recognized many years ago that there is a way to describe Einstein's equations in terms of high dynamic description. So here is a list of questions. Either there is a tension in the correspondence on gravity, either this is incorrect or that is incorrect. If we can reconcile both, we also have to address the question of how is it that we have quasi-neural modes in hydrodynamic, in general relativity, in black hole perturbations, and in hydrodynamics we have exponential growth at least for some amount of time. And once we go there, we also should see if a whole bunch of concepts that we know in hydrodynamics actually play a role in the gravitational case. So I'll show you some examples of how this comes about. In particular, this is important because if turbulence does take place in general relativity or in gravity in ADS, multiple scales would pop out dynamically without necessarily being very deterministic. We know the linearized analysis is not sufficient, but turbulence also shows another set of interesting properties like self-familiarity of the spacetime, and so we might have a fractal structure of the event horizon itself. And the spectra of the energy might leave particular relics in the in gravitational waves, matter and energy that may be interested for observational purposes. And some are questions that I won't get into here in this talk. So let me just tell you a few things about the ADS EFT and how we're going to, in the gravity fluid correspondence, and what we're going to learn from it. So in its very simplest or cleanest definition, these folks are here. Said, well, let's consider in a very special case. We're going to think that we have a black membrane. That black membrane is described in this particular way with respect to null coordinates. And in the absence of any perturbation, it's just a boosted black brain is parameterized by this vector here, which is describing the boost, and this quantity here that essentially tells you the temperature of the black hole. And now what you do is you allow these two functions to have some slow variation with respect to the coordinates. And then you do a gradient expansion of the equations, of Einstein's equations. And order by order, what you realize is that Einstein's equations can be recast in a way that looks exactly like hydrodynamics. In particular, you realize that if you project Einstein's equations on the ADS boundary, if you want, the momentum constraint tells you precisely the conservation of the stress energy tensor. And the Hamiltonian constraints tells you that there is a fluid description of the system, and that fluid, this stress energy tensor, has to be traceless. And again, if you analyze these equations, there should be turbulence, or you would imagine there is turbulence. But more importantly, we also know, at least in the Navier-Stokes case, that there is a crucial difference between hydrodynamics in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, and hydrodynamics in higher dimensions. Namely, that in two dimensions, there is an inverse cascade of energy. You put energy in some given wavelength, it wants to go to longer wavelengths rather than shorter wavelengths in the higher dimensional case. The reason for that is that there is another conserved quantity called entropy that exists in two dimensions but not in three. And so the first thing we did is just to make sure that we could see that precisely that quantity or an analog of that quantity in the relativistic case existed. And this is something we constructed. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but essentially it's the vorticity of the fluid. There is a quantity that is associated to it that is conserved in two dimensions that you cannot say anything about in higher dimensions. Even though you could construct it, there is no reason for it to be conserved. And it's that quantity that is conserved that forces perturbations in the fluid to move to longer wavelengths. But of course, in order to check all this, the best thing to do is just get yourself a large enough computer, write a simple code in this case, and then just see what happens. So this is a movie I'll show you of the vorticity of a fluid flow. This is the fluid that is dual to a gravitational black hole that has a given boost in 3+1 dimensions. We're going to be doing 2+1 hydro, and we're going to see if turbulence kicks in there. And as you see, initially nothing is going on, but very quickly a whole bunch of structure pops out, essentially out of nowhere. Of course, they were initially seeded by very, very, very small value. They were taking energy of the main mode that we put initially, and those take off exponentially. And also, you see that as time goes by, longer and longer structure takes place. So again, this is the first first message we get. It is, again, the duality. The duality works between the field theory in d dimensions and gravity in d+1 dimensions. So that observation that we have made before to push against turbulence, because 3+1 general relativity simulations were not showing the formation of shorter wavelength scales, That was perfectly consistent with the duality, because in the dual picture, you have a 2 plus 1 hydro, and in 2 plus 1 hydro, you go to longer wavelengths, so there was nothing new there. You can also ask, well, what happened? What is the structure of the perturbations that we have put in the space-time? How is it manifesting with respect to the space-time itself? Well, what you're forming are gravitational waves that essentially propagate from the boundary all the way to the horizon in kind of localized regions. So you're generating something like akin to gravitational wave tornadoes. They are compactly supported. So the gravitational wave energy is such that it's sufficiently self-gravitating to keep itself together, but not so much that it will collapse. And they're just staying as coherent structure, and they just go on. So if you didn't believe that at least in this case the duality was working just fine, you can also consult this paper. So again, Paul Chesler and collaborators, they had a 3 plus 1 gravity code in ADS. They take exactly our initial data. They solve now Einstein's equations, and they project they obtain the stress energy tensor on the boundary, and then we just can compare at different times. And these are just times taken at comparatively qualitatively similar regimes. Remember, we have a turbulent regime here, so it's not possible to compare one to one. We're losing predictability. But qualitatively, it's obvious that the gravitational behavior is mimicking exactly the hydrodynamic behavior as the duality is telling us. More interestingly, is what happened if you now consider the dual not to a boosted black hole, but a dual to a Kerr ADS black hole. So we're going to put a Kerr ADS black hole there. The dual fluid is a kind of a uniformly rotating fluid on a sphere. We're going to put a perturbation there. Again, we're solving hydrodynamic equations, and we're going to see what happens. So because now we're on a sphere, we cannot use a single patch to cover the whole sphere, so I'm using this kind of cube sphere. So this is the north patch, the south patch, and this is the equator, and the map onto this one. So all this region in here is kind of the equatorial region, and these two are north and south pole. So we're going to be doing the same thing. We put some initial perturbation. I'm showing you the vorticity. And after a while, again, you see all sort of structure coming up. And then slowly, different vortices will come and join and form longer and longer vortices. And they realize one particular known fact of hydrodynamics in 2 plus 1, that if you have two vortices with the same sign, they can join. If they have different signs, they will repel each other and move away. And ultimately, you end up with two vortices, one near the north pole, the other one near the south pole. And you could just think a little bit about, for a while, as to say which one should have gone to the north and which one should have gone to the south based on this assumption that vortices of the same sign have to move and vortices of opposite move together, and if they are of the opposite sign, they have to repel. So in the gravitational side, you would think that you have a black hole, the Kerr ADS black hole here, with a cloud of gravitational waves on the top, and a cloud of gravitational wave near the south pole, and they're just going around. But again, this extends all the way to the boundary. So you have two tubes. Right. If viscosity is here, then it just slowly dumps this, but the structure stays there. So the duality just tells you precisely what's going to happen. Good question. I'll get to that in a second. And there might be some interesting, I'll tell you right now here. So the observation is if we're thinking about 3 plus 1 gravity, then it's fine that we cascade in the opposite into longer wavelength scales. But if you now try to think of the first question of thermalization, how long will a system will take to go back to equilibrium? We know that qualitatively will be completely different. Because if we have 3 plus 1 ADS black hole that is perturbed, we move energy to longer wavelengths, to longer modes. Those modes decay more slowly than shorter modes. And so in 4 plus 1, you're going to have a much more rapid thermalization than in 3 plus 1, simply because you're putting the initial energy in two different extremes. So now back to Niaish's question. Yes, I mean, we don't know about the stability of ADS in Kerr, But at least, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch. We do know that 2 plus 1 Navier-Stokes problem has been solved. There are global solutions. We don't have the analog in 3 plus 1. So to the extent that we can use the Navier-Stokes results to infer back on the gravitational side, it might be telling us that Kerr-AdS in 3 plus 1 has a much better chance of being stable than 4 plus 1. So again, qualitatively, they could be completely different. But this is an open question. Right, so what these vortices will do is just very slowly decay. The problem is that there is an instability, and this is the question, this is why there is a question about what the end state will be, and this is the super radiance instability that Mina referred to yesterday, which is much more simple to realize in this scenario, because while she was trying to put a barrier somehow there, either by using Preston-Tucholsky mirrors or some massive scatter field, here you have ADS, so ADS is there. So that's And, but it acts in much longer time scale, so we don't know what the end state of that is. So, how am I doing with time? 10 minutes. Okay, so I'm gonna. No, that's okay. I think I have more like 20, but that's okay. So, I'm not gonna say much about this, but one of the interesting things that you also might want to wonder is whether ADS was required to have this turbulence, or was just a convenience. So I'll just give you the punchline, and then we can discuss more. And ADS was just convenient. We didn't need gravity in a box for turbulence to take place. So you could have said, well, maybe ADS was important because you put a gravitational perturbation there. It cannot escape to infinity. It can only fall into the black hole. And so you have a lot more time to just to slosh around and do something. But the key point here is that is precisely what is the last statement I made, that you need a long enough time for interesting nonlinear effects to take place. So in order to address these questions, to show that this is the case, what we did with Juan and Stephen Green, and Aaron Zimmerman, was to then say, well, forget about ADS, throw it away, and concentrate on asymptotic flat spacetime. So now gravitational waves in principle can go out, but concentrate on the case where the quasi-neuronal modes we know are very, very slowly decaying. And that's given by a Kerr black hole with a very, very high spin. Where nature realizes that is a different question, but at least from the fundamental question, we don't need any, we get rid of the ADS, we concentrate on a situation where the perturbations will just hang around for long enough. And if you do that, then there is a way to do a bona fide, intrinsically gravitational perturbative analysis and find out that indeed there is an instability very closely related to the parametric instability of oscillators that would actually show that indeed some modes that initially were very small take energy from the main mode and just grow exponentially for a while and then turn around. Furthermore, you can use this analogy to describe and define a gravitational Reynolds number, and you can say, or you can show that above it, you can trigger this instability, and below it, you don't. And therefore, turbulence in gravity is much more generic than just in ADS. But let me just move on. So that was one case where we started with a thermal state because we initially had a black hole, we perturb it, and the question we wanted to answer was what happens and how long did it take to thermalize. So now let's consider a completely different case, one where you start with pure ADS. So initially we don't have any temperature notion even, but we're gonna put some energy there because on the field theory side, that describes some initial state and we want to know what happens. At very late times we expect or we would have expected things will thermalize. Somehow the system will find a way to reach equilibrium. So this question, interestingly, was not addressed till the work of Bisson and Rostorovsky about 2 or 3 years ago. What they did is essentially reproduce the so-called chop-tweak problem. So what you do is the simplest possible, because again, you're gonna do something numerically to be able to track the system in a simple manner. You're gonna assume spherical symmetry, and the energy is going to be provided by some scatter field. So you're solving Einstein-Kling-Gordon in ADS. You put this tiny amount of energy, and what Choptic did was in asymptotic flat. You know that if you put very little energy, this scatter field will go towards the center, bounce off, and then disperse away to infinity. If you put a lot of energy, you form a black hole, and then the question is what happened at the very verge? And by answering that question, he opened up this field of critical phenomena in general relativity. Bisson and Rostorovsky did exactly the same thing in ADS. So now if we put two-liter energy, what they saw is that this thing bounces off the origin, goes out, but now it interacts with the outer boundary, the ADS boundary, and can come back in. And if you wait long enough, eventually a black hole forms. And so this is a plot of the size of the black hole that they form versus some perturbative, but some parameter that governs how strong was the initial energy in the initial configuration. And as you lower the strength of the initial perturbation, they found that they always were able to find a black hole, provided how far they could push the numerics. And so then they conjecture that for all possible amount of energy, arbitrarily small energy in ADS, you will always form a black hole. So that is a result that is rather convenient. In fact, when people from holography, at least from the R camp, not from the gravitational camp, heard about this, they said, well, you guys are excited about nothing. This is a completely obvious result. You can put some amount of energy on the field theory side, you wait long enough, it will thermalize, that's a black hole for us, we're done. Why are we even discussing this paper to begin with? Well, at least from the gravitational point of view, we still wanted to know what happened. What makes collapse or bounce number 2 be different from bounce number 23rd? What mediates, from a kind of first principle point of view, this ability of the energy to be transferred to higher and higher frequencies to eventually have enough frequencies, enough energy in a short enough wavelength to form a black hole? So Bisson and Rosorowski, what they did was to identify a couple of properties of ADS. First, the scalar energy that you put in has a set of eigenfunctions with the eigenfrequencies completely fully resonant, so they're totally commensurate. So they say, well, what happens here is something akin to turbulence. In some sense, you put energy in a mode, because it's resonant with modes that are higher frequencies, eventually it will go to sufficiently high frequencies to form a black hole. And so then they put further credibility to their conjecture that in time scales of about 1 over the energy, you're going to form a black hole. So these were very compelling arguments till you actually started looking at the problem in much more detail. So in particular, what we did with Alex Buchel and Steve Liebling was to revisit the problem and found out that in ADS, there are tons of families that are completely stable. They don't seem to ever thermalize. They're perfectly happy being what they are, even though they could be non-stationary. And so this is a plot that basically even reproduced the same family of data that Bisson and Rosorowski used, but this, we said, let's even just change the initial configuration. You just, instead of having something that has this given width of narrowness in the initial configuration, just make it a little bit wider. And do exactly the same experiment. And as this is the time to collapse versus the strength of the perturbation. And for some families, you had essentially a monotonic behavior that always took you to a black hole. But some other families just turned around and they didn't seem to collapse. Or at the very least, if they eventually collapsed, they do so in a very, very different path. So these ones were monotonic. This, at some point, it wants to go something completely different. So this is the time to collapse in the vertical axis versus, if you want, the amplitude of the perturbation you put in initially. In the Bisson-Rosorowski picture, for arbitrarily small perturbations, you always form a black hole. And it follows a 1 over epsilon, or 1 over epsilon square, or 1 over energy time scale. In the R case, you now change, take exactly the same data and make it a little bit wider. And now that happens. Those are the ones. And more curiously, if you make it even wider, then you go back to the R case. So it seems that it's very, very dependent on the initial state you started with. You either thermalize in the simple picture or not. But now if we take those scenarios that do not thermalize, or do not seem to form a black hole, let me just not use the word thermalize now, it might indicate that a perturbative analysis should be applicable provided the initial amplitude is small enough. So we revisited the perturbative analysis with Stephen Green, Alex, and Stephen Liebling, and Balasubramanian, with a much more powerful perturbative approach, which is one called two-time scale expansion, where you actually realize that there is a system finds a way to have another time scale in the system, which is the time scale by which different modes in the solution can exchange energy. Once you take that into account, you realize that you can write the equations of motion at the perturbative level, which will show some oscillations in a very long time scale, you show that you can completely remove the resonances. So that observations that Bisson and Rosorowski had made, that because the system was fully resonant, that drove the collapse of a black hole, need not be the full story, because at least with this order, you can completely remove it. But furthermore, the interesting thing that this equation show is that there is a direct connection with a very old problem, the problem, so the so-called FPU, Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem, which is known perhaps as the very first example where computers open up a completely new field of physics. And if you never heard of what the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem was, let me just tell you in a few words. So essentially what they said is, take a harmonic oscillator, a whole bunch of them, coupled with a cubic or quadratic potential. In this case, we're assuming a quadratic potential. The equation of motions are governed by, well, the ones you know, plus some perturbations. And what you find out there is, if you put a little bit of energy, the system, or the, what they saw, the system apparently failed to thermalize. So here is just some plots of that problem for some initial energy that you put in, and this is the energy in different modes of the oscillations. And so then you see that the initial energy comes down, that is giving energy to the other modes, but at some point this turns around and goes up again and essentially goes back to the initial state, and this keeps going on for essentially as long as you care to run. Interestingly, what they found out is that also if they put the initial perturbation a lot more strongly, then the system de-thermalize. And this scenario, let me just show you this. This is an example of precisely what we're talking about. So if you put a lot of energy in the system, this is the energy in the individual modes versus time. And at some late time, they all kind of seem to agree the system has reached equipartition. If you lower now the initial perturbation, now each individual mode seems to stabilize, but to different energies. And so what we're showing is this ADS problem shows exactly the same behavior. And so there is a problem, because now it's saying that if you thought that the way the field theory was going to thermalize, initially you put some energy and you, at the end of the day you expect to have a thermal state, well, forming a black hole was a very convenient route, because you form a black hole. That's a small black hole. If your initial perturbation is small enough, that black hole will Hawking evaporate, leaving a thermal state behind. But now they're saying that, okay, something, the system must find a completely different way to reach that thermal state. And so you could say, well, there are some caveats or some ways to address this problem. One is to recall that you're using spherical symmetry. In the field theory, that means you have chosen a particular restrictive setup, and so maybe you have restricted the number of ways that the system could or would need to in order to thermalize. But if I believe this holographic duality, I can put my gravity hat and say, wait a minute, on the gravitational side, I have perhaps the ideal case to form a black hole. I have spherical symmetry, I force all the energy to focus at the origin. That one doesn't thermalize, or doesn't, if that one doesn't form a black hole, I have a hard time thinking that a more relaxed symmetry situation with the same amount of energy will find it simpler to form a black hole. Maybe the answer is that one doesn't need to go through the black hole. There is a sort of correspondence point at which below which the thermal state is actually an exact string. These are things that I'm still trying to understand. There are two ways out is, well, when, maybe this is an artifact of the complete classical calculation. There are 1/n² corrections that should have been included because we're we're forming a black hole that is very tiny. And I'll make a comment about this in a second. Or maybe a more general concept of thermalization applies. And there is this context of eigenstate thermalization or this many-body localization that some systems do not have to thermalize, and we have to learn how to live with it. As far as this next to last point, that we haven't included 1/n² corrections, well, we don't know how to do quantum gravity calculations, so the best thing we can do is just try to incorporate some features that we may expect a theory of quantum gravity will tell us, and which is higher curvature correction. So we take Gauss-Bonnet, which is, I mean, it's just a toy model for some of these corrections, and we ask the question, well, how will this system behave? Does it find it easier to form a black hole or not? Again, you can go through this this two-time scale expansion, solve the problem or find out what the equations of motion at the perturbative level is, and you very quickly realize there is a map for any theory that has any arbitrary value of lambda that is allowed for by physical considerations. They all can be mapped to the same problem we solved before for a value of this being zero, that is, again, Einstein ADS, for a slightly different value of the perturbation parameter. So what we're saying is there is a universality class of, that basically says all these field theories that are described by these models have exactly the same kind of behavior. They all have shared the same failure to form a black hole. So furthermore, the R property that we know these theories have is that they have a mass gap. So you can know for sure that below some certain amount of energy that you put in, they have no way to form a black hole because there is a mass gap. And therefore, from there, you can infer also that ADS might never form a black hole, at least for these classes of families. In the virtue of time, let me see if I can wrap up. So from my point of view, so holography studies definitely have or furnish all sort of interesting, rich, and motivating, compelling questions. The dynamical studies of ADS are definitely fascinating. And they are intriguing and compelling consequences or ways out of to try to extract answers from them. Yet, I think there is still much more to be understood for the application of this duality in dynamical settings, because as I said, there are still questions that make me a bit uncomfortable. In particular, let me just remind you that black hole ADS are conjectured to be unstable. And so, do we have any right to ask what the end state is? Just to stress and not to try to punch my friends who are mathematicians, but this conjecture is by mathematicians. And so this is a conjecture as far as the asymptotic state of the system is. And so what they point out is that if you perturb a black hole in ADS, the final state will not be described by the same family you started with. So from a physicist's point of view, that statement might mean very little at the end of the day, because if at the end of the day, the end state is a black hole with a very, very dilute kind of hair of energy that essentially is inconsequential, we might not care about. I don't know, but it would be interesting to have a straight answer to that question. Pure ADS has definitely both islands of stability and instability, and so it seems that, again, different conditions have no problem going through a black hole to produce a thermal state. Others have to find another way, or perhaps we just have to expand our notion of what thermal means. And this is the question I asked Dima at the end of his talk. In the Fermi-Pasaulen problem, people understood, and there is a criteria, that you know that if you satisfy with respect to your initial perturbation, the system will thermalize in the usual sense, and below which we will not, and it will just seem to get stuck in this quasi-stable state where there is interchange of energy but never equipartition. And finally, just wrapping up this concept of trying to plow with numerical simulations definitely help a lot. They provide intuition, but they can only do so much. So there is always room for trying to go and then using simulations to push for the right analytical approach to try to get more robust and general answers to the question. With that, I'll stop. Thanks.
We have just a couple of minutes for questions.
So I want to go back to what you said about turbulence in ordinary gravity. I'm not sure I followed everything that went by so fast, but you talked about you talked about 3+1, and you also talked about 4+1, if I understood. So is this, first of all, was the statement that you get turbulence even in 3+1, but we didn't recognize it before because it has a different kind of scaling? It
right.
Evolves towards, but you, in some sense, we do have turbulence even in asymptotically flat 3 plus 1 gravity, is that the claim?
Right, what we find out is that the behavior is generic. I mean, if you just, if it should be there, generic in the sense that it needs to explicitly say, but if you think if it's there, or if you buy it's there in the ADS case, now you say, what is ADS providing? It's providing a cosmological constant with a lower order term from the purely partial differential equations point of view. You haven't changed the problem at all. So it was very strange to think it would be there in ADS and not in the asymptotic flat case. But what we can say now is in the asymptotic flat case, if you have a regime where the perturbation lasts long enough, hangs around a particular region long enough, nonlinearities will kick it in. And there is a very clear path to it, at least, or at least part of it. There is an instability where you can see that the energy in a mode will want to go to another mode that is longer wavelength. In the calculations we've done at the 3 plus 1 level in the gravitational side. In the 4 plus 1 level of the gravitational side, the duality will tell us, they will tell us that things will have to go in the opposite direction. That's a calculation we haven't done, and that's a calculation that cannot be probed with numerical simulations. And it will take a long time before doing that, because you could, in principle, do the 4 plus 1 simulation, but computational costs will require you imposing symmetry, and the moment you impose symmetries, you kill the effect.
So in that connection, you said that you conjectured an analog of a Reynolds number for the gravitational
correct
side. Did you tell us, or can you tell us what that analog is?
It's actually pretty simple. I didn't tell you because I rushed through that, but let me see if it's here. No, it's not here. But it's given by this. So at least in the case of a black hole. So we're gonna write this. Rigi essentially needs to know what is the amplitude of your perturbation. Again, at least in the case of a black hole, so we're perturbing a thermal state, divided by the azimuthal wave number, and one divided by the imaginary part of the quasi-normal mode that basically tells you how fast this is going to decay. I mean, this is what the calculations show us. But now we can say what is the relation of this with the standard Reynolds number. Right, this guy is a perturbation, so that, let me call it, that's a velocity. That's 1 over m, 1 over azimuthal number. That goes like wavelength. And this omega is telling us how fast things are going to decay. The analog on the gravitational side is rho divided by nu. And that's precisely the Reynolds number. So it comes very natural. And the calculation you did here is very different from the one you did here. Here, you just recognize that there was, at least in principle, you recognize there was this parametric instability and ask the question, when will it kick in? And this comes right up there.
That's beautiful.
No, this is perturbative calculation, and most of this was done by Huang Yang, sitting somewhere in the audience. Second-order perturbation theory of black holes that people have not recognized before because they were casting the perturbation in a completely different way. So they would have had to go to third order, perhaps, to recognize that behind it there was an exponential growth, and from it obtain the condition. Here we use the intuition of how to obtain or how to understand turbulence will kick in the hydrodynamic side to redo or rethink the perturbative approach or the perturbative calculation to second order that essentially implicitly threw in the resummation for us, and then we see it right away.
Okay, unfortunately we have no more time, so you can save your question for the panel discussion session. Okay, our last speaker is Laurent. Let's thank Louise for a beautiful talk.